and welcome to episode 79 of the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast. I am Patrick Macias, the author of the new book, Mondo Tokyo, Dispatches from a Secret Japan.
And I'm Matt Ault, the author of Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World. Happy Valentine's Day, Patrick.
Happy Valentine's Day to you too, Matt.
What did you get me?
Well, Matt, I didn't know how to tell you this, but Godzilla got a big old butt, so I'm leaving you.
I'd be honored to be left for Godzilla. That's I wouldn't see that as a negative at all. You know, Valentine's Day is a little bit different here in Japan than it is in the West. I mean, it's kind of like seen as a hallmark holiday abroad, right? I'm sure it had some connection to some religious tradition or some pagan, you know.
A saint, I think, is involved on some level. I can't quite remember.
Yeah, and you know what? I don't care. All I care about is chocolate Easter bunnies. Are you one of the starting with the ears or starting with the tails type?
That's a personal question, Matt. But yeah, I can never really figure out the rules of engagement for Valentine's Day here in Japan. It's like, I'm supposed to give them to the woman or the woman gives them to me. I forget which way. Razor Ramon tried to explain this to me one time and I didn't understand.
I'm reading this off a website because, you know, the web is the most important thing on this. Men are usually expected to do very little on February 14th. And it is the women who are expected to be the principal gift giver. Yeah, women.
Who wrote this? The Ghetto Boys? Did like Willie D from the Ghetto Boys write this?
I love how matter of fact it is. Men are expected to do very little on Valentine's Day. And you know what? Any other day too. Yes, Valentine's Day is a day when the ladies give the men chocolates here. The day when the men give ladies chocolates is what, Patrick? This is on your final exam. Do you remember?
Oh, it's called White People Day, isn't it? That's March 14th.
Just whiteness. I don't quite know where that comes from.
If it's all white, it's all right. How does this work, Matt? You explain this to me. I think you're better qualified than I am just based on skin color alone.
I'm incredibly qualified. Here I am looking it up on Wikipedia, the Japanese Wikipedia, that is. White Day. So it says here that White Day, and I'm translating this like as I'm reading the Japanese on the page because that's like my superpower. White Day is a holiday when women traditionally give white chocolates, marshmallows, and candies to men. And it's based on Valentine's Day. So it's like a true story. So I guess the whiteness comes from the fact that you're not that you're giving chocolates to white people, though I'll take chocolates from whoever would give them to me.
That's the plot for Godzilla Minus Two, isn't it?
Yes, Major Spielberg. Anyway, I guess the whiteness comes from the fact you're supposed to give white chocolate and things like marshmallows that are white.
Has anyone ever given you a marshmallow on White Day? That just seems like that's inconceivable. I don't even know where to buy marshmallows in this funky town.
Now that I'm looking at this, this is reminding me of another really, really funny Japanese tradition, which is called giri choco, which is, it's obligatory chocolates. And by the way, this is unlike honmei choco, which is given to actual romantic partners. Giri choco, obligation chocolate, is that you give it to male like co-workers and stuff. It's not like a come on, but it's like, it's a burden. Like you're expected to go out and buy these chocolates for people. I don't think this happens much anymore. I think this is kind of a relic of the Showa era, kind of like us. It's another aspect of the wacky localization of Valentine's Day in Japan, which is that you've inverted the genders to women giving it to guys. You've inverted the colors. It's not brown chocolate, it's white chocolate. And you've even inverted the emotions. They've subverted them by making it obligatory.
Is this the same giri that's in Giri Ninjo? Like,
yeah. Giri, obligation. Well, the gi is the same. Yeah. So like Jingi Naki Tatakai. So chocolates without honor or humanity.
Or obligations. Yeah. I'm down for all three of those things, actually.
Exactly. So it is Valentine's Day here in Japan. And oh, by the way, I think we should mention, you know how like Valentine's Day is considered to be a, you know, a hallmark holiday in the States. Here in Japan, it seems like Fujika, the chocolate and candy company, was big behind kind of popularizing Valentine's Day and White Day in Japan. So it's sort of a hallmark holiday here too, except just promoted by other corporations.
I mean, there's a profit-making aspect to this whole thing. I thought this was all about obligation and feelings and stuff like that.
I thought it was all about bunnies. bunnies, like the birds and the bunnies. It was all about how, isn't it how like babies are made? Don't they come out of eggs from rabbits?
That's a whole nother discussion for a different podcast.
That's the next episode. We're not old enough for that yet.
Yeah, I feel like doing very little today as my obligation as a man is to receive things today. So,
I'm just going to sit around and not do much of anything because some website told me that's what happens on this day. But yet here we are. We're working our butts off for the listeners, Patrick. That's what we bring it. We bring it. Like, just like Taylor Swift, who always performs her best and was just here in Japan actually recently. And I think we're kind of almost on her level. We're kind of getting there.
I'm on the level of Tom Swift and his giant atomic telescope or something. That's the only Swift I know anything about.
I know Tom Swifties, those like wacky jokes, you know, about like, did you hear the guy who tried to kiss his girl in the fog and missed?
I think you're thinking about Bazooka Joe.
It is like Bazooka Joe. Yes, it is. It's like dad jokes, but kind of with a little bit more thought put into them.
We've got a lot of those here today. So did you want to get into the news here? I think something happened this weekend. You were out of town. I was busy doing my taxes. This was not a good weekend for, I guess it was a 3-day weekend here in Japan, and all kinds of otaku stuff was like popping off all around us.
Yeah, it's crazy how much stuff was going on. Like all these people were in town, all these events were happening, and I just happened to be out. Hiroko wanted to go visit Yamagata Prefecture, the snowy wilds of Yamagata Prefecture, which is really awesome. We stayed at a ryokan up there and did a little hiking around in the mountains. But in Tokyo, where the center of the universe is, Wonder Festival was happening. The massive convention for amateur makers of all sorts of one-day licensed products based on popular characters.
Speaking of Wonderfest, I realized we went together last year, 2022, and I saw some old pictures, you know, pop up my memories or whatever. And quite frankly, Matt, I'm amazed and surprised we survived and made it out of there alive.
Yeah. So the way Wonder Festival works is you're either a dealer or you're little people, Patrick, or you're one of the
skin jobs, is that what they call them?
Exactly. If you're just an attendee, you have to line up outdoors to get in, and they basically like it's like the running of the bulls in Spain. Like they open the doors and everybody rushes for, like, you have little maps. They give out maps beforehand, and you've probably already figured out where you want to go because you're there for some limited edition exclusive item, and this sea of humanity rushes in and buys everything up. So if you're anywhere near like the middle or the end of the line, which means that you didn't start camping out 10 hours before the damn thing opened, you probably aren't going to be able to buy much of anything, but there's lots to see. And that's what we did. We still had to line up. It was still like we went there like way after opening, and there were still like dribs and drabs of people going in.
And like, you have to do paperwork. You can't just go in. Like, they want to know your name, your social security number, your My Number card, your taxpayer ID identification. It was like, Jesus Christ, lady, I just want to see some Godzilla models, you know?
And if you're wrong about any of it, they cancel your permanent residency. It's really, really a dangerous game. Perhaps the most dangerous game of all. But we didn't go this year, but a good friend of ours, to protect the guilty, we'll only call him by his first name, Keitaro. He went to help at the table of a friend of his who is a sculptor of Godzilla resin kits, Tanaka. Tanaka-san.
Is it Tanaka Studio or something like
that? Yeah, Tanaka Studio. Yeah, yeah. And he does these amazing, amazing, like large, pretty large.
They're pretty big.
Yes. And like, I think he got the license to do Godzilla from Minus One this time. He tries to do the latest Godzilla, whatever it is. And it's pretty easy to get a license for Godzilla for these events. Like, Toho is pretty open about it on these one-day events.
Has he done the Hanna-Barbera Godzilla?
You know, he hasn't. We should totally get him to do that in Godzuki. I wonder if I can convince him to do that.
Up from the depths, 30 stories high.
Probably never talk to you again, Matt. It's probably like an insult to ask like one of Japan's finest Godzilla modelers to do like the Hanna-Barbera Godzilla.
It's like, to paraphrase that Yakuza guy from Black Rain who said we made the rain black. Like, you made the Godzilla comedic.
No, they did it first, man. I think after Godzilla versus the Smog Monster, you can't really blame Hanna-Barbera.
But the thing is, Smog Monster, Godzilla is kind of like funny in that, but the theme is deadly serious, Patrick.
Pollution, Matt. What are we going to do about it? Did we make the right decisions?
I don't know if it's at pre-pandemic levels, but the crowd was much bigger this year than last year. And I heard from our friend who was helping out at Tanaka-san's table that they were super strict about checking the paperwork. It was like trying to pass through customs. Like, are you a dealer? Show me your dealer pass. Get on the ground. Hands behind your head.
Put them on the glass.
Put them up against the glass. Put your credentials up against the glass. And so our buddy had a hard time. I mean, he made it in, but it was like navigating like checkpoints in some kind of like third world country, having to like show your paperwork over and over and over again. But he survived. They made it to the table. They sold a lot of stuff.
Did you see anything online that made you like angry at yourself for not actually physically being there?
There was some really cool stuff. There was this guy selling who's been making these really nice vinyl figurines of like 8-bit video game characters, but like, you know, in cartoon style, like they looked on the side of the cabinets, and like he's done like the guy from Ghost and Goblins, or like, you know, the all sorts of ones. And he had Dig Dug and one of the Dig Dug monsters this time. And I was like, man, I really wanted that. That sold out.
Has he done Mr. Do? Is he considering the clown from Mr. Do?
He's doing deep cuts. He did Mighty Bomb Jack. I don't know. You have to really be an 8-bit like nut job to remember Mighty Bomb Jack, but he did that. And a bunch of other ones. And it's just, I love that somebody's doing this. And this is Wonderfest in a nutshell. Some crazy person making some character that like even the company that owns the rights to it wouldn't be so insane to make a figure of it because they know only like 100 people want it. But that's all you need at Wonderfest. That's all you need. I think for me, and it wasn't on sale. It was only on display. These jumbo machinders. So we're talking 2-foot like Shogun Warrior style, sized. Giant vinyl figures of Mach Baron. These things were crazy. They looked absolutely amazing. And they were displayed in two variations. One is the realistic type, which looked like Mach Baron on the movies, or excuse me, on the TV series. And the other one was gussied up to look like the old Chogokin toy with like chromed, you know, shoulders and thighs and stuff like that. And I was like, man, I want this. But it's like 98,000 yen. It's like $800.
So the hottest things I saw at Wonderfest online, one of which will be commercially available pretty soon. X Plus, my Godzilla vinyl figure guys, are doing the Cybot Godzilla from 1984. Remember in Godzilla 1984, they built this like giant, useless robot Godzilla for the close-ups. It cost like $500,000.
Right.
It looks like something you'd pay to throw baseballs at a carnival or something like that. Like it doesn't match at all with the actual suit in the movie, but they made a 30-centimeter figure of it, and it's derpy, it's goofy, and I gotta have it when it goes on presale.
That's actually really, really amazing. I think actually, did they or did they not? I'm pretty sure Medicom released a vinyl of that a couple of years back.
Yeah, people have made figures of it in the past, definitely, for sure. I would not be surprised, because it's one of the, you know, kind of the deep cuts in the Godzilla suit library, and I'm surprised X Plus is even going this route, because, you know, the next level after doing all, whatever, 40 odd Godzilla suits is now these like variants. All that's left are like the Cybot, yes, or like the water tank suits, just these like weird odds and ends.
Or the Godzilla theme park building from, is it Gigan?
Yeah, the Godzilla Tower. That just came out from X Plus a few weeks ago as well.
That thing is amazing. Describe it. Describe it for people who don't know.
The cockroaches from Nebula Space Hunter M come to Earth, and the way they're going to take over the Earth is by building a children's amusement park with a life-size statue of Godzilla at the center of it?
The construction committee for the world's children's land.
You know it.
They're the ones building that Godzilla tower.
That's right.
Oh, what is this? Am I supposed to start shoveling dirt?
Just cut the humor and let's go.
Is this real? Is this real?
It's based on a true story, yes. It's a documentary shot in real time.
Well, it's kind of like how they built that life-sized Gundam in Yokohama, which we still haven't been to. We need to go there before the North Koreans drop like a missile on it. Isn't that what those missile flyovers, those occasional missile flyovers are about? They're trying to hit the Gundam in Yokohama. I don't know who would win or lose in that conflict. I think like actually blowing up the Gundam would be kind of like a massive PR win for everybody involved.
I think it'd be a 7-year war based on some of the propaganda I've seen so far. The other thing I saw at Wonderfest that was really hot that made me want to go there, these wild guys who are doing like 3D printed kits, they're called MEF and Team Strike Group. I'm not sure if these are the guys who will help out if the 7-year war actually unfolds. They're doing the spaceships from Sayonara Jupiter, this like that weird Toho, let's turn Jupiter into a sun movie that has awesome spaceships designed by Studio Neue. The movie's like garbage, but the spaceships are like amazing.
Yes.
And for $300, you can buy these 3D printed kits that are pretty astonishing and pretty huge. And they also did the Liabe from Message from Space, which is arguably a superior design to like the Millennium Falcon or something like that.
It's totally, yeah. It looks. Do you remember when Haraguchi-san went over to his house and he was restoring that one? It's like the size of a Kotatsu. He had the
actual
one.
No, he wasn't restoring it. He just had it. We were begging him on our hands and knees to restore it.
Please, for the love of history, for the love of everything that's holy, restore this.
There's pictures of us online somewhere of us holding the like charred and burned remains of like the actual shooting model of the Liabe from Message from Space.
So I missed Wonderfest. I'm sad about it, but every time I go there, it makes me want to try my hand at making something. Not myself, but like, you know, working with a sculptor and doing something. I've always wanted to make little vinyls, but it's just there's so many people making little vinyls now. Like little vinyl robots, little vinyl kaiju. It's and half of them are foreign. It's just like this whole cottage industry has really exploded over here.
Are you gonna do it? Are you gonna live the dream someday? Because I know you've talked about it. You've kind of revealed to me some of your secret plans, but I don't know.
I'd love to. It's no secret, Patrick. I collect vinyl robots and things like that from the 70s, 80s, and even today. But there's a lot of holes in the lineups that people made back in the day. You know, like they made Macross vinyls for some ungodly reason, but they didn't make every single, you know, vehicle design. And so I've always been like, you know, hey, maybe I can get like a one-day license and make that stuff. The problem is that when you make a vinyl, you need like $5,000 or $10,000 invested up front. Like the idea is you're going to make it back when you sell the stuff, but you have to make it to begin with. Nobody can give you money for that. So it's like, geez, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, well, the good news is this thing called NFT, and it's a lot easier to make, man. You can make a lot more money on it, believe me.
I'm just going to start making JPEGs of random stuff and selling them. And then if people, please support us. And you can't really do a Kickstarter because it's like you need the money to even get started. It's not like you can, you know, get the money and then deliver whatever it is that you thought you were going to make.
Wait, first you get the money, then you get the power, then you get the Valentine's Day chocolate.
And then somebody in a Hawaiian shirt chainsaws you in a Miami bathtub. I think that's how it works. I haven't already made it all through every step yet, but yes. So Wonderfest, we missed it. It happened. I have a really, really strong suspicion that if we went, it would be exactly like every other time. What if they say like madness is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different outcome? Wonderfest is kind of madness in that sense. We go every single time and it's always the same.
I'll sleep a lot better at night when I have the Cybot Godzilla and the Liabe for Message from Space. So I don't have those yet. So,
well, the good news is I invested in one of those video podcasting rig things with like microphones. So one of these days we can take it to the streets. Maybe we can go out and actually film ourselves at one of these events instead of just recording audio. We're still like in the radio era of entertainment. You know, we haven't even gotten to moving pictures yet. It's like Marconi telegraphs, crystal radios.
You should see me making all the sound effects with like the coconuts and like the typewriter and stuff like that.
Yes, exactly. Totally. I just don't want to get into having to edit video, man. I don't know how these like podcaster dudes, YouTubers do it. It is a pain to edit video. It takes so much longer than just audio.
But imagine filmmaking, Matt, on a grand scale. Imagine a maestro like Martin Scorsese making a new Super Bowl commercial featuring aliens from an obscure Japanese science fiction film, Matt. This actually happened. Martin Scorsese delivered a Super Bowl commercial for Squarespace that has aliens from Daae's Warning from Space, 1956. Did you see this yet?
I did. And I didn't see the Super Bowl, but I saw this one ad. So, you know, good job, Squarespace. I guess you got to, like, you know, watch your PR. I literally don't even know who played in the Super Bowl or even won it. I gather there were some people upset about the outcome or something. Anyway.
Was it Big Jim Slade from the Kansas City Chiefs from the Kentucky Fried movie? Wasn't he involved?
Big Jim Slade.
Did it involve Diapolon or what other Japanese shows had like football motifs? Actually, Mach Baron did. Weren't they like
all the bad guys are dressed like American football players and they throw like explosive footballs at everyone.
If the sport were more like that, I'd actually probably be more in tune with, highlights like the Super Bowl. But yes, this ad, Martin Scorsese's ad, which is, you know, barely even an advertisement for what it's advertising, but it's just very cool. It's like a little mini doc. It references that. What is the Japanese movie again? It's like, A alien appears in Tokyo is the Japanese title. Chujin
Tokyo ni Arawaru, is that? So it's, yeah. Warning from Space is the English title. 1956, Daae, the first color Japanese science fiction film. It's beautiful to look at. And yes. It's really too bad because in the commercial, they show it.
Black and white.
Want to make it look like an old black and white movie. So they desaturated the color. And the aliens are very distinctive. They're like guys in starfish costumes with giant eyeballs. They look like the residents, but they were designed by your favorite Japanese avant-garde artist list in mind, Taro Okamoto.
Yes, yes, of the Tower of the Sun from the Japanese 1970s Expo. Also of that amazing painting that is hanging over Shibuya Station, inside Shibuya Station. The I think it's called Myth of Tomorrow. Just a great Japanese pop artist. It's an amazing movie. I've actually only seen the scenes with the weird ballet moving star guys in it. I haven't seen the whole film. Have you?
Oh yeah, no, for sure. You know, the aliens have come to warn Earth about this like giant asteroid that's going to crash into Earth, and you know, no one likes them because they're aliens. But there's a big disaster scene where Tokyo gets flooded, like Tokyo Station. It's some pretty great miniature work. There's no kaiju battles, but there are starfish aliens. I'd like to think Taro Okamoto is in one of the costumes, although he probably isn't. But the whole gag about this Martin Scorsese commercial is like aliens are arriving on Earth and no one notices because they're too busy looking at their phones. It's quite witty and innovative. Not as good as Casino or Taxi Driver, but definitely...
biting social satire is what you're saying, huh? I never ever thought to imagine that maybe we were paying too much attention to our cell phones. I have to thank Mr. Scorsese for opening my eyes to this incredible, incredible new development in human history. Well done. But I know, jokes aside, I actually really like the video for what it was.
At one point, the UFO flies over the Shibuya crossing.
Yes.
And I was really hoping they were going to blow it up Independence Day style and just get rid of all the Mario Kart racers like in one fell swoop.
I'd actually be fine. I don't want the Mario Kart racers to die. I'd just be fine with aliens abducting them and just taking them all off this planet, put them somewhere else. You know, they want to be on that like Mario Kart track, that kind of fantasy track. So maybe look at their wish one of these days.
We could make the whole joke about, yo, what about illegal aliens, Matt, at the Shinagawa Detention Center?
Exactly. Well, you know, it's Martin Scorsese is not the first man. I was going to say man of letters, but I guess he's man of frames.
Lenses.
Lenses, man of lenses.
Lens man. And are you talking about Lensman, Matt? My favorite.
Do you believe in the lens, Patrick? I do. He's not the first of the big shot, old school, awesome filmmakers to be into Japanese pop culture. Like famously, your favorite director, George Lucas.
Wait, he's a director?
No, he did one movie. He did THX 1138.
American Graffiti. Yeah.
Oh, he made that? Oh, wow. Did he make any movies after that? I'm not quite aware of them. Anyway.
Message from Space came out, and so there was this ripoff called Star Wars that just wasn't quite as good.
So he famously came to Japan to study tokusatsu before he launched into making Star Wars. And there's a lot of apocryphal accounts about this. I suspect there's more written about it in Japanese than English, because Japanese love, you know, talking about how, you know, Western people have like learned from them and been influenced by them and then in turn influenced Japanese people. And there's some talk that Yoda is actually named after the cinematographer, the cameraman that Akira Kurosawa used, who apparently Lucas had engaged with when he was here. But even before that, like Stanley Kubrick, do you know him? I think he made a movie too. Stanley Kubrick was a big fan of like, not of tokusatsu so much, although I don't know if he wasn't, but of anime. He loved Astro Boy and sent Osamu Tezuka a letter like directly saying, hey, you know, I love this cartoon. Can we collaborate on something? And Tezuka being Tezuka is like, oh, I'm too busy. Who is this guy?
Do you know when that was? Was that in the 60s? Was that in the 70s?
I did a deep dive on this when I was researching Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World, on sale at a bookstore near you. But Tezuka wrote about it in his own autobiography and even reproduced the envelope, not the letter, but the envelope. And it's stamped 1965.
Huh.
So like I had initially thought, wow, maybe this is about AI, the movie that Steven Spielberg ended up making. But it sounds like that was based on a novel that didn't come out until 1968 or 9.
A short story, yes.
A short story, yeah, that's it. A short story. By who's the, do you remember who it was?
Brian Aldiss.
Yes, the famed Brian Aldiss, actually. Like maybe he had the idea for like a Robo Pinocchio like knocking around in his head, but it's just as likely that he was just getting started on 2001 or something like that and just wanted some kind of science fiction, you know, that he could do like bounce stuff. Can you imagine what 2001 would have looked like with like Tezuka's designs in it? Like Tezuka's like super Disney wacky slapstick. That's like what he is. I can't even imagine him and Kubrick meshing well, but it's fun to imagine.
It sure is. My understanding is that when Kubrick was researching 2001, he made it a point to literally watch every science fiction movie he could, including Japanese ones.
Right.
So he was delving into all kinds of science fiction. And that's probably something George Lucas was also doing on Star Wars, especially when it came to special effects. I think people kind of forget that for a while, while there, Japan was considered the home of like the best special effects, the most advanced special effects in the world. So they had to come here and kiss the ring at a certain point. And then when he found out Toho was cranking out Godzilla versus Gigan, he's like, oh, maybe I should make my own special effects studio instead of hiring these guys with the cockroaches from outer space and the Godzilla tower.
Was like, no, you know what? I'm going to top this. Somehow I'm going to top this. I want to make my own movie about space cockroaches and kaiju theme parks. I can do it. I know it. Actually, it's funny. I was at the Ryokan I was staying at in Yamagata. There just happened to be a copy of Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 Space Odyssey on the shelf. And I started reading it. And this is a digression, but I think it's one that you in particular will appreciate. It's good. It's actually good.
It's good for what it is, you know.
Yeah, no, it's good for what it is. You know, there were some things about it I liked and some things about it I didn't. But actually, the thing I liked most about it is it goes into, like, at times, really odd detail that's not in the movie. And that, this is fine. This is what books do. They can, like, kind of illuminate internal states or, like, go into details that had to be cut because they didn't work visually. And one of them is in the part of the book that corresponds to where Dave and what's the other guy's name?
Frank and Dave.
Frank. So, like, Dave and Frank are, like, kind of maintaining the ship and, like, you know, running around their little, like, treadmill and, like, you know, hitting buttons and playing chess with Hal and, you know, taking birthday messages from their parents. Arthur C. Clarke goes into a lot more detail about, like, everything that NASA or whatever it's called in the book is did to make their lives as, like, easy and comfortable as possible in this harsh environment. And there is this paragraph where Dave is back in his room in his bunk, and it's like, you know, it talks about he takes pills to, like, if you can't sleep, you can take a pill. If you're sleepy, you can take a pill. That's fine. You know, I get that. Astronauts take their pep pills and stuff. But then there's this digression into, but what about loneliness? What do astronauts do? In times of old, sailors would pull into ports and find women, but that's not possible in space. But the engineers have come up with these pills that you can take and go to sleep and see some wonderful dreams. I'm like, wait a second.
Those are sex packets, man.
Exactly. Is this where the Digital Underground came up with the idea for sex packets? The album that introduced the Humpty Dance to the world in 1989? I literally, it must be. Like, Arthur C. Clarke invented sex packets.
And then he moved to Sri Lanka. So you do the math, okay?
Now we have to play a little bit of the pioneering song. It's called Packet Man.
Will you be needing any packets today?
Yo, B, don't be pulling on my jacket, okay?
Cool, just trying to get your attention so you can take a look at this invention. Now peep these, I got some more in my jacket.
Man, what are these, condoms?
Sex packets. It's like a pill, you can either chew it up or like an Alka-Seltzer. Dissolve it in a cup, and get this, see the girl on the cover? You black out, and she becomes your lover.
You're tripping.
No, I'm serious, these are authentic.
Yeah, well, I don't take hallucinogenics.
Wrong again, my man, this is way more real. But since you know everything, I'll make someone else a deal. Packets, got them packets.
Did Eiji Tsuburaya invent that after Ultraman or before Mirror Man?
Don't blame the sender. I'm only the man who carries the sex packets. I don't make people take them. But apparently Dave and Frank were popping these pills and having some pretty interesting dreams in zero gravity.
Now you know. That's one to grow on, I guess.
It's funny because the movie is so, like,
sterile. Yeah.
It's very sterile.
It's like the space stewardess puts the pen back in his pocket. That's about the extent.
Actually, that gets expanded on muchly in the book. Apparently, not on that like space Concorde that they fly on, but in, like, that ball-shaped, you know, moon lander. There's one of the stewardesses is from Bali and entertains the everybody by doing Balinese, like, dances in zero gravity.
There once was a stewardess from Bali.
There's a stewardess from Bali, and so you didn't need sex packets on the moon shuttle. Apparently, you only need them on the Discovery when you're, like, out near the orbit of Jupiter. Anyway, huge digression. Sorry, people. Sorry, folks. Sorry, anybody who doesn't remember the Digital Underground.
Back to Scorsese. I mean,
yes, back to Scorsese.
No, he actually has gone on record for, like, decades about how big an inspiration Godzilla and Ishiro Honda, specifically name-checking Honda, were on his development as a filmmaker. As a kid, he, of course, was a cinephile. I don't know that he had a history with Warning from Space, this movie in the commercial with the aliens, but it's possible. In the commercial, they show him watching the film on an iPad. He looks like Woody Allen. They're literally merging into the same person now. outspoken big fan of Japanese film, not just Kurosawa, but also maybe the first kind of big mainstream filmmaker I ever heard name-checking Godzilla and Honda as like a positive, as like an inspiration.
Well, the good news is he's agreed to come on the podcast next week, so we can just ask him directly, right? Right? Did he responded to you, right? He didn't respond to me. I just assumed he sent the response to you.
Yeah, I need that like meatball recipe from, was it like Goodfellas? But I need to know how to make the meatballs when I'm high on cocaine.
Keep stirring the sauce. Yeah, exactly. When the helicopters, when the cops are like tracking you, keep stirring the sauce, man. So apologies for the digression, but.
That was a good digression. Any chance to talk about sex packets with you, Matt, especially on Valentine's Day?
It's true. It's fine. That's a sad day when you need to open your sex packets on Valentine's Day. Come on, man. Is that geary? Is it obligatory sex packets?
Obligation sex packets. So we have time for one more news story today, Matt.
Well, the Dragon Quest thing is simple. It's that this last weekend was Dragon Quest III, then Enix, not Square Enix, but just Enix. The role-playing game dropped for the Famicom and caused like a scandal. This is like 34, it was like 86, I believe it was. We should probably actually know this if we're talking about it.
I've never played a Dragon Quest game in my life. There's no C4. There's no sniper rifles.
I can do one up on you. I've never played one either, but I translated two of them. I translated me, Hiroko, and I as part of teams. These are big games. You can't. And in fact, Dragon Quest games are known for having some of the most dialogue in any game because the whole point is just to keep you playing for as long as possible. Just like Pachinko. We translated parts of Dragon Quest 7 and Dragon Quest 8. Those were like our two big titles that we worked on.
Can I play 8 if I never played any of the other ones?
Yes, they're all kind of standalone. They weren't sold in the state. I mean, they were like on the Famicom, on the NES, Dragon Quest 1 came out as Dragon Warrior. They changed it for some reason. I think it was some kind of like copyright issue or something like that. But Dragon Quest 3 came out in 1988, February 10th, 1988. And it was a big deal because the Famicom, aka what became the Nintendo Entertainment System, was considered kid stuff, like the toy. It was sold in toy stores, but it was adults who were lining up to play Dragon Warrior 3, like these huge lines of people camping out overnight, young people, kids cutting school, like, and it was like a big deal. Like there was all these reports on Japanese TV at the time. What is happening to our society? Kids are playing video games. Oh my God.
Seismic shift in entertainment consumption.
It's almost like Japan invented the modern world, the world we live in, Patrick, through video games. No, but seriously, it was a big deal. And it was kind of the inflection point when role-playing games, and especially computer role-playing games, went like truly mainstream in a civilization. Like they were still kind of niche, nerdy stuff, even though there were a lot of people playing computer RPGs like, you know, Ultima and things like that in the States. Like Dragon Warrior 3 was not big among nerds. It was big among, but it was also big among average people.
You mean losers. You mean adult losers.
Patrick, don't be mean to the vanilla, what vanilla is like, that makes it sound like it's some kind of sex thing. What do you call average folks?
Futsu? I don't
Futsu.
Know. Normies? Normies. Let's call them normies.
Let's call them normies. Normies were playing Dragon Quest 2. So we were into it before it was cool, except you weren't, but I was. Maybe. Anyway. So yeah, February 10th, 1988, a day that will live in infamy. The day that computer role-playing games began to colonize the world. So speaking of colonists, Taylor Swift, she was here that same weekend.
Oh, Swift-O-San. Yeah, I kept hearing them talk about Swift-O-San on the news. And again, I thought it was like, Tom Swift. All right, I'm ready with my giant atomic telescope. I'm ready with my transistor radio. Let's go. Let's go.
Are you a Swiftie, Patrick? Are there any Swifties in your house?
Thank God, no. No, I've convinced the people in my house that it's 1984 right now. We're listening to a lot of like Cyndi Lauper, Kaja Gugu. We're almost ready for like Bananarama. I think we might bring that into the rotation.
It's pretty amazing to me because Taylor Swift is one of those celebrities who is just astoundingly huge. And I literally don't think I've ever heard one of her songs. And this isn't some kind of like, I didn't see Star Wars. Like, it's not like, I don't say this as a stance. It's just, we live in a world where you can't just casually like turn on the car radio or like walk into a supermarket and hear her playing like you would back in the, you know, in the Showa era when we were conceived and decanted. You'd actually have to seek her out. And I don't.
I mean, I go record shopping like once a week and all the record stores, 50% of them are just, you know, vinyl LPs of the new Taylor Swift, and they're playing it and they're just trying to shove it down your throat like Vogue Rock. You know, I'm gonna let her finish, but I gotta say, you know, Bananarama is the best female entertainment act of all time.
Hey Taylor, ever. I'm gonna let you finish. The big headlines here were about misbehaving fans in the audience, and there's been a lot of controversy in that one place that loves controversy, known as Twitter, about whether it was foreign fans or Japanese fans who were the bad fans.
And not just misbehaving, the word barbaric, Matt. The word barbaric is now in the conversation.
There's no over-dramatization here. There's complete barbarian. So they were wearing, wait, were they wearing like pelts? Did they have like stone axes? Did they have the hairstyle that James Earl Jones did in the original Conan the Barbarian? That's the question.
Yeah, so all these barbarians will eventually graduate into like kingdoms and stuff like that, won't they?
Like civilization, like the video game Civ. Yes. So wait, what was the barbaric behavior they were doing? They were like leaving their seats and like moving up to a closer seat.
That's never happened at a concert, has it?
Also, I hear a smartphone or two was hoisted, you know?
Yeah. So wait, so Japanese people were pissed off about it on Twitter? Is that how this worked?
No, I think how this worked is somebody on Twitter saw somebody mentioning something on Twitter and pulled a Twitter by making it seem like a much bigger deal than it is. No lives were lost. The barbarians did not sack the Taylor Swift concert. I think everybody left. Sound of mind, if not hearing.
Yeah, I would have thought Johnny Somali would have like raised the bar for like barbaric behavior like a little lower in Japan than just like moving up in a concert or holding up their phone. But I mean, like I did see this other video the other day on Twitter. It was a Japanese guy working at a Domino's pizza, and he picked his nose and like dipped it in the dough. And that struck me as somewhat barbaric, actually, Matt. Call me old-fashioned if you will, but I'll take the pizza with nothing.
Apparently, they closed the entire franchise down and are like taking legal action against, you know, okay, people have been doing stupid, dumbass pranks from probably the moment humans like earned their consciousness or aliens gave it to us or whatever happened. But like the idea that you would do something stupid like this and film yourself doing it and then upload it to the internet is like, it's mind-boggling to me. It's like stupidity on so many levels that I just don't even know how to process it.
Well, I mean, the idea that you would get up out of your seat and move towards the stage and hold up your phone.
It's barbaric, Patrick. It's barbaric. I don't understand what's happening to young people today. They're trying to get closer to the music that they paid a lot of money to see. What's happening? Next thing you know, they're going to be buying video games and like lining up for role-playing games.
Yeah, or lining up for like vinyl model kits of Godzilla and stuff like that. What a world, what a world, what a world.
Life like time, it's a flat circle. And that brings us back to the beginning.
Hey, Fred, give me a pizza with extra cheese.
Extra cheese.
And hold the tomato sauce.
Hold the tomato sauce.
And hold the crust.
Hold the crust. Hey, Jimmy, give me a cheese with nothing.
Nothing? Now you can have the best part of the pizza without the pizza. Polio string cheese, all natural, individually wrapped cheese snacks.
Is this what you want?
Bellissimo. Magnifique.
C'est bon.
Try Polio string cheese. It's the best part of the pizza.
So thank you so much for listening to the Pure Tokyoscope podcast. Thanks so much for supporting the show and knocking on your neighbor's doors in the middle of the night and telling them to listen too. We appreciate it.
Yes.
And thanks so much. And we'll be back with a new episode next week.
And just remember, don't look down at your cell phone so much. Martin Scorsese told me so.
See you next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.